Many don't believe that either the trumpets with melodious noise or the infernal din await us where the road ends. But most, I fancy, have discovered that to be born is to be exposed to delights and miseries greater than imagination could have anticipated. That the choice of ways at any crossroads may be more important than we think, and that shortcuts may lead to very nasty places.
Hello, and welcome to the Pilgrims Podcast. This is the Progeny speaking. I'm also joined today by the Professor.
And the Patriarch.
Yes. And we're coming back to you after a two-week hiatus, I think. Or maybe we just missed 1 week, but I can't remember. Anyway, the last time we were here, it was August 21st. So, yeah, and we actually recorded a week before that, so it feels like a really long time.
It does feel like a long time.
But, yeah, and it's been kind of an interesting two or three weeks for us as we're just...
I've got my new Kanye album. Of course, I've been listening to that a lot.
Yep. The patriarch has a double life. He's sometimes kind of the mild-mannered engineer, but then the rest of the time he's moonlighting as a rapper.
Yeah, that and Eminem, you know.
Yep, Eminem like the candy. That's gonna be. Yeah, well, there was, I know I've probably told this story before, but there was one occasion on which the Patriarch posted on his Facebook that he was going to quit his job and go into rap, calling himself J-Al. However, some members of our Facebook following didn't realize that it was April 1st, and by the time that story slowed down, it had produced some rather entertaining conversations. Especially from your mother, who she called up and wanted to know why little Alan was quitting his job and was this the end of the world?
Yeah. There was another time that I posted something like, you know, got a call from Dan Schneider, interested in a new opportunity in Northern Virginia, and then I put like excited with a bunch of exclamation points after it, which was a reference to Dan Snyder, who owns the Redskins, and that he was looking for a new coach, and so it was just a big joke, and all these people started chiming in. Oh, I can't believe you're leaving! Don't go to Northern Virginia! Oh, are you crazy? And all this stuff, and I'm like, you know, they obviously didn't know who Dan Snyder was, or what that the Redskins go through,
or that you would never put smiley faces on a status unless you were joking.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean. Guys, really, you need to be able to read the Patriarch a little better than that.
It's okay. It's okay. It's all good.
No, there was a time in my life when I used LOL regularly, but I have moved on. I have left that behind. However, you know, I think that it ought to be in the rules of the internet I do think that people ought to have to like go through a driver's test before doing the internet anyway.
So now you just put LMBO, right?
LMBO is possibly the most Christian euphemism ever. Yeah, I mean it.
Well, you are we all know that you are a SMIT, right?
Don't you mean SA?
Oh yeah, that's right. I'm sorry. SAIT.
We are really bad with our.
I'm sorry.
Yeah, well, my mother.
It's been a long day.
Yeah, S.A. Should we even say this on our family podcast?
This is
a loving term that my mother uses for me. It stands for S for smart ass in training.
Oh, you're gonna have to beep that.
Am I?
Yes.
Do we have the ability to beep things? Well, you know.
I remember Andy Rooney once talking about the 7 words you couldn't say on the television.
Oh yeah.
So neat because he had a blackboard and he had the numbers 1 through 7 on it, and then out from each one you could tell that each one had been erased. Oh, that was classic.
Well, maybe you know, if you do put your podcast on with like foul language on, you have to put explicit.
Well, we might get a different clientele.
Yeah, that's true, you know. The one explicit version, you know. Though it doesn't say what is explicit. You know, that could be...
Well, it is in the Bible.
That's true.
The old King
James, true.
You know.
Balaam's...
Balaam's, yes. He was actually talking to him.
As Rich Mullins used to say, God spoke to Balaam through his ass, and he has been speaking through asses ever since.
Yes.
So if God should choose to speak through you...
Donald T. Rump, for example.
You'd not think too highly of yourself. Which, that whole little anecdote there basically justifies the existence of the Pilgrims Podcast.
Yeah. Never let it be forgotten that I
am an ass. Yeah. For those Shakespeare fans, we just went all intellectual on you and quoted Shakespeare.
So it's in Shakespeare and it's in the Bible.
Yeah, I am an ass.
You're probably on pretty good ground.
Well, that's one of my favorite scenes in Shakespeare, too. So, okay, well, maybe we should try and, I guess, act our age now.
I'm going to get a drink while you're talking about that.
Well, our last...
Nothing alcoholic, though.
Yeah, because we are in the Bible Belt, and, you know, there's only so far you can go. But like 2 weeks ago, we were talking about the movie Possession, which was fun, and I actually really enjoyed that one. We enjoyed having an opportunity to rather goof off, and I think that the whole us acting out movie scenes is something we need to do again because we are both so bad at it, and I was trying to do like a half British accent or something, and I don't even know what I was doing, but you know, if it sounded like we were making fun of the movie, it wasn't. It was just that we were really bad. Our acting careers are...
What were we doing?
Yeah, we found a transcript of the movie. We needed to, like, quote it. And so we read through the movie, except we didn't know whose part was whose. And it turned into a love scene. And that was really awkward. So, yeah. You know, if you guys missed that one, then that's something you needed to hear.
I don't know about that.
Or not, yeah. So anyway, the movie was a suggestion from Daryl Sala, who's a good buddy of mine on the internet, and he left a few comments, one of which I answered, and the other two I guess we can talk about now. One of them is just kind of addressing the movie as compared to the book, which Daryl has obviously read, and which I have not. But it does sound really fascinating, because that's... At the moment, I have just finished reading a bunch of really long, tedious books, so I'm just kind of coasting and doing nothing but listening to, I don't know, Bruce Dudley Edwards, who's marvelous. So maybe later on. But he points out that Christabel Lamott, who was one of the characters, is based on Emily Dickinson, and Randolph Ashe is based on Robert Browning. So that's kind of cool. I'm actually not as familiar with Browning, but I do know a little bit about Emily Dickinson. I was in an American literature class last year, and I only really remember things about Walt Whitman because the professor insisted on reading long segments of Whitman out loud. Especially the embarrassing segments. So yeah, that was difficult to forget. But I don't know as much about the other two. So yeah. Anyway. Yeah, I think you may.
Is this where I talk about Jennifer Eel?
Yeah, you can go ahead and say that.
Which is just
Ely. You know, she's American. She was actually born not far from here in Winston-Salem, North Carolina.
Well, yes. Is it? That I think that part of the problem with us is that the whole Pride and Prejudice thing is ingrained in the soul and sinew of our little family, to the point where, I mean, we know it's really pathetic, and so you know, we could have learned a foreign language in the same amount of time that we've spent on watching Pride and Prejudice, but and so she's it takes a while for, and in fact it's very difficult to separate that character from any other character that she plays when I see her on the screen. So that was part of it.
Yeah, at one point you said, you know, she's practically part of the family, Jennifer. Yeah. You know, it is. It's so weird because I can just... There are two things, you know. I think that one and probably Lord of the Rings that have just become so ingrained in me that I can just tell you every scene that's about to come up, you know, and I can practically quote whole scenes. My mother actually can. She can... It's incredible.
The maker.
You know, so... I actually have a friend on Twitter who's experiencing it all for the first time, and it's just giving me so much joy.
And there's, you know, that's somewhat the way with Empire of the Sun with me.
Like with Christian Bale?
Well, yeah, and then just that I really, 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 really like that movie a lot.
You need to do that one sometime.
But, I thought we'd already talked about that, have we not?
No, we haven't. We talked about talking about it, but we didn't. Because I love that movie, too. But it's apparently an acquired taste, because not too many people like it.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, yeah, you know, it's funny, because Colin Firth, I can take him seriously in other roles. But I think it's kind of sad that Jennifer Ely's never had too much of a huge career after Pride and Prejudice, but I don't know.
Yeah.
No,
but she's very good.
Colin Firth, though,
she's good in that too.
He does say, it's funny, he says, I'm very well aware that if tomorrow I give up acting, become an astronaut, and go to the moon, the headlines will read, Mr. Darcy lands on the moon. anyway, first world actor problems. So, I guess we are going to move on to our topic today, which... We're not going to be talking about a movie so much as we're going to kind of be talking about, like, cultural matters and all that stuff. And specifically, I wanted to talk about, and this is something that I've kind of been thinking on over the last few weeks and the months preceding, just with the topics in the news and the topics just that have kind of gripped the country as a whole, and which... are really important, I think, and are shifting dramatically as the 21st century continues. And central to all of that is the value of a human life. And that's the building block upon which society is built, is a human life. You know, so why is that important? Why is that important on a metaphysical scale? So that's kind of what I wanted to talk about. I wanted to start to kind of dig into some definitions to talk about more than just kind of the sappy sentimental stuff, and also to move beyond merely just approaching it from a theological standpoint, because there are lots of Sunday school answers you can throw at these questions. But I wanted to, especially in our, you know, in our society today, you can't always justify those things theologically. So I wanted to approach it from different ways as well. And that brings me to my first question, which is, why are humans exceptional? And that specifically, why are humans exceptional in the animal kingdom? What makes us different from other primates or from other animals? From
deodorant. Probably has a lot to do with it.
I mean, you know, that's helpful. But, so yeah, if you look at a human being... I was talking...
Me, for example.
I'm looking at... Yeah, I was talking... You know, it's funny because I talked about...
A human being.
I talked about this to my grandmother the other day, and she was and her response was, well, it's becoming increasingly difficult to tell the difference.
Yeah.
And I'm like, well, that's... Okay.
That's one way to look at
it. Yeah, but that's... But that's kind of not what I'm getting at here. You're not being very helpful, Grandma.
That's still a pretty good answer.
Well.
But anyway, I know what you're...
Yeah, so. But which of those comes first, though? Maybe that's an interesting question to ask, too. Is, do humans act like animals when you treat them like animals? Or, you know, why do humans become more like animals? But let's answer the basic question first, though, you know. What are the obvious differences? Are there obvious differences?
Well, you want to answer first, or you want me to answer first?
I can take a crack at it.
All right.
I think that you're going to have to go beyond merely physical things, because as evolutionists are always pointing out, there are a number of physical similarities between humans and monkeys and so on. If we're just looking at it from a biological standpoint, humans aren't genetically more complicated than or in any of that stuff. I think you're going to have to look at more abstract things that to look at human exceptionalism. I mean, here I am recording my voice on a hunk of metal that was designed by human beings. It just you look at New York City and you say, okay, that's probably not something that you're going to see the apes making anytime soon.
They've got far too much class for that.
Dad. Or you look at the Mona Lisa or any of those things and you just think these are truly unusual things in all of nature. Humans have created unusual things. And I've got a blog post upcoming about this, but the idea of art I think is really important to that as well. But I want you to go ahead. I've got more to say about this,
well,
but I won't.
I would think, and I thought about this the other day on the way to work, actually, although I don't know if I can remember what I came up with. But I think I came up with two things that, maybe in three, but I only remember two of them. And because if you think about the ability to create or to build or to do some of those things, well, there are species that can do that, you know, and that have done that. Maybe not, obviously not as sophisticated as we are, but they still can do that. Whether that's build their own shelter or you know, some of the, you know, use tools. So even though, I mean, those, in my opinion, those really don't separate us from them. I kind of came down on the side of one being communication, which is that the Mona Lisa is a way to communicate, right?
Yeah.
It's a really sophisticated way to communicate, but that is a method of communication. And I know there was a scene in a movie that I saw years ago. I think I was probably in a hotel or something, and I don't know the name of the movie, and I don't know what it was about, but it was really cool because these missionaries are walking through these woods with some Indians or, you know, and they can actually kind of talk to each other, but at one point, one of the guys goes up to one of the Indians and I don't remember exactly the circumstances, but they were talking about riding, and he's like, "What's riding?" And so he asks this Indian chief, he says, "Tell me something that only you know." And the guy says something like, you know, "Well, I killed an albino deer when I was 12 or something like that. And the guy writes it down on a piece of paper and he says, "Come with me." And so they walk, you know, across the field there, and they walk up to another Englishman, and he hands him that piece of paper, and the guy says, "Oh, the chief killed an albino, you know, deer when he was 12 years old." And the chief's jaw just drops open. Is like, you know, how did he know that? You know, and that's something that a 3-year-old or even obviously preschoolers can understand the concept of writing, but it's a big deal. And this whole idea of communication, I mean, that's my job, is we put together engineering drawings. Well, those are just a way to communicate, right? A lot of the things that we end up doing, if you don't build something with your hands and you're communicating, if you're in engineering or if you're an architect or if you're an insurance salesman, if you're an accountant, if you're a lawyer, all of those things have to do with communication. So the word, you know, the books that we read, the newspapers, the policy, the laws, all of that stuff that comes back to communication. And while it's true that you know, honeybees can communicate with one another and tell each other where the honey's at. And you know, other species communicate in all different ways. We have taken that to a completely different level, and that's one thing. But the other thing, which I really think separates us from them, rather than communication, it's kind of on the technical side, is the concept of joy. And that's not something. I mean, animals may have a concept of happiness or of pleasure or, you know, satisfaction. But so far as the idea of joy, even in pain, even in distress, to have true joy, which, you know, is my belief, only through Christ, then that is truly what separates us from the animal kingdom. And that may be a little bit hard to kind of to flesh out a little bit, but joy, the more I've been thinking about joy lately and how it's so different from happiness, it's truly a big deal. It's something that our society, I think, has forgotten about. A lot of the Christian churches have forgotten about. And unfortunately, a lot of Christians have forgotten about. So even in despair, even in trials and tribulations, you know, that the Bible says that the joy of the Lord is my strength. Well, that's an unusual and just a crazy way to look at that. That's just, you know, if I were writing a Bible, I would say, you know, the strength of the Lord is my strength, or the sovereignty of the Lord is my strength, or the justice of the Lord is my strength, or the, there's so many other attributes that you could plug into that. That's not what it says. It says the joy of the Lord is my strength. That just seems so unusual, so crazy, that that's what you would expect God to say. So, yeah, that's mine.
Well, I've kind of got something sort of similar, but that's a really neat observation that hadn't even occurred to me. Mine is, I had come up with three qualities which I thought separated us, two of which are commonly claimed, I think, by atheists or people who want to have a reason for humans to be special, but that I don't think are sufficient. And then the third one, which I think gets more at it, and I'll examine both of those, and what we can, I think, talk about how prevalent they are in society today. I mean, the obvious theological answer to this is to say that what makes man special is the Imago Dei, the image of God. And that's the obvious, the Sunday school answer. What I am looking for here is are there legitimate answers to that question other than divine image? And I think that there are, but I think that... But I think that they're basically describing the divine image without using that word. Say, okay, this what is different about human beings is these qualities, and these qualities amount to the divine image. But it's probably useful to break it down in order to talk to people who don't believe in God. So a lot of people, and especially Americans today, I think, focus on intelligence as the primary attribute, which is, and they've kind of got this idea, I think, of sort of a, of the mind being the most important part of the human being. There's a book called That Hideous Strength by the professor, as it happens, in which he mixes science fiction with mythology. And the story is kind of vaguely this. I haven't read it in a while, but I remember a little bit about it. His villains are a bunch of evil materialistic scientists working for aliens, sort of. It's all very complicated, but there's this horrifying scene in which Mark, the ordinary Joe protagonist, comes face to face with the villain's picture of humanity's future, and it's nothing but a head kept alive by machines. The next step on humanity's journey is to jettison our weak flesh and then just try and become as much of a brain, a mind, as possible to transcend. And that was a really scary idea. But he wrote this, you know, like back in the 50s or 60s. And I think that has really just become more and more popular. It's last year, watched a panel discussion with several conservative thinkers, one of whom said that if it came down to humans being able to transfer our consciousness, our minds, to a robot form and then continue living forever, he'd do it in a heartbeat. And I just, you know, my jaw hit the floor and I thought, this is that hideous strength come to life, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And it was so chilling. And it was very welcome to see that Scott Ott seemed to have somewhat of the same impression on the panel. The Christian representative, he's like, wait a minute, let's think about this. But that's something I think we're rushing towards without thinking too much about. But it's not a new idea. The idea that our flesh is something that is needs to be purified or jettisoned completely because the mind, the spirit, the soul, is the only pure part. That the body isn't even important. You know. So is there any truth to that biblically? Can we back that up?
Back what up?
The idea that the flesh is unimportant and that only kind of the inner life is important. I mean, that's basically Gnosticism, which is a heresy.
Hmm.
But how do we back that up scripturally, I guess?
Well, that the, you know, one of the things that I think is maybe worth at least pondering there is that as you were talking, and I'm sorry that my mind was kind of wandering, but one of the things I was thinking of was whether or not another thing that separates us is this idea of death and how we approach death. You know, most animals would not like it, right? And they flee from it. And we do too, unless you're Christian, kind of, you know. And but anyway, I'm rambling here. But one of the things that I've been thinking about also is that for example, cancer. You know, we really are fighting to eradicate cancer because it destroys the body, right?
Mm-hmm.
Well, let's say tomorrow we do that. Let's say we come up with a relatively cheap and inexpensive way to handle just about any kind of cancer you've got so that it becomes almost just routine, you know. Well, you know, you're going to die of something else, right? And what that something else might be, it might be vastly worse, you know. I remember hearing that once that they used to call pneumonia the old folks' friend because, you know, a person might be languishing in their bed for weeks or months, but once they got pneumonia, you know, it was really only a matter of days before they would pass away. And I was thinking, well, I know obviously if it's a young child or if it's a young mom, you don't want you don't want them to suffer and to lose their life from cancer. And I'm not saying we shouldn't do those things, but that we fight, you know, it seems like we fight for this life a little, we love it a little bit too much, and we fight too hard for it, that we don't have, you know, we love this flesh too much. And there, you know, I don't think, from what I understand with that, is that the intellect isn't worth saving, necessarily. But there's more to a man than just his intellect, right? Make sense? Doesn't that make sense?
Well, sort of. I mean, it's more along the lines of that people people, I think generally the problem is more that they think the mind is something separate from the flesh.
Right.
That it's something kind of floating up above, and that it's unimpeachable, and that reason is, I mean, we're living post enlightenment now, and the enlightenment thinking has taken over so much.
Right.
And reason is the one virtue. You
That's
know,
right. It's the keystone. It's the keystone for like all of civilization. You would think.
Yeah.
Intellect. Right.
Yeah, and I think that
it's one thing that you
because
can't.
Because our society values intellect so much.
Right.
And because it's made it trendy and glamorous, and you know,
yep.
We marginalize those that don't have it.
Right. And you don't need to look any further than the whole global warming thing to see that. Right. I mean, you can't even. Right.
Yeah. Well.
You can't even.
Yeah.
I mean, if you're in a college situation, you can't even begin to take the opposite opinion.
Well, that's not so much a problem of marginalizing people who aren't intelligent, but it's a problem of marginalizing people who are intelligent because they're going against the status quo.
Right, but this whole idea of the intellect of, you know, oh well, smart people know this.
Yeah, and our definition of smart people is people who have degrees,
right.
People who have, you know,
which is
we
ridiculous.
Have a very, I think, narrow conception of what intellect is.
That's right. It has nothing to do with wisdom.
Yes. So that there's something that I think you can start asking a question about. What you know, is intellect is wisdom merely having a lot of intellect, or is wisdom adding intellect to something else? Is there another quality that you can add to intellect which would produce wisdom? I mean, I think our definition of wisdom as being really, really smart is a wrong one. What I would say is that wisdom is intellect with
plus discipline.
Well, plus discipline, plus morality, plus a connection to the more organic feelings. You know, because you can study a book on communication all day long, and then you know you drop you in the middle of a group of people you've never met before and have no idea what to do. There's something
I don't even know if it's got anything to do with intellect so much. I mean, it does, but
that's something more that you have to learn through experience, through human connection, through feelings. You know, that through those things you
what?
Learn wisdom.
Yeah.
I mean, because even our intellect is guided by our morality.
Let's hope. Yeah. Well, yeah.
Or it should be. I mean, we don't always admit it, but morality is something that guides how we use our intellect, and morality is something which isn't always influenced. I don't think you can build your morality out of logic. I think a lot of people have tried, and it hasn't worked out very well.
That's right. I mean, for example, in engineering world, if I make a mistake. Let's say it happens pretty regularly. I mean, is it make a mistake on something, a calculation or whatever, and I have to be able to, at whatever point the project's at, you know, let's say they're out there building it, I've got to be able to say, wait a minute, I made a mistake, And instead of this, you need to do that. Okay. Now, I have to run through a whole series of processes before I make that call. First of all, I have to be absolutely sure that my calculations are right. Second of all, you start to think, well, you know, the code says this, but does it really? You know, you really think that's going to happen? Now, it doesn't really matter. If the code says that, that's what the code says. However, there are in the code ways to, you know, exceptions or you know, that you can talk to the building official and get the snow load reduced or whatever. You know, there's a whole host of ways to go about that. But there's this whole process that you kind of have to go through. But after you exhaust all those, your morality has to, you know, I physically have to make that call to other people and say, I've made a mistake. If I don't, then I'm putting a lot of people's lives at risk. I mean, it's a moral thing, but I almost have no doubt that there are engineers out there who say, it's probably going to be okay. You know, I mean, it's just one more beam size up. What are the chances of that ever happening? I mean, you know, we put this live load on the beam. What are the chances of it ever seeing that full load? Almost zero, and that's absolutely true. You know, there's very conservative design approaches. There's factors of safety built in. All of that stuff's true. But if I'm going to sleep at night, you know, on a moral side of things, then I have to say it's wrong. And I have to let people know. It's a tough thing.
You know, and if you were approaching it logically, then you could look at those statistics and say, okay.
That's right.
You know, but that's the thing. Life is, you can't suck all the emotions out of a room and then deal with other human beings. It's just not possible. And it's not possible either, I think, to become a good human being or even a great human being without recognizing that fact, just trying to do this really reductionist type of logic. And I think that Western society in general has leaned far towards more towards that line of thought than it should.
But then they're going to say...
And that's because of the Enlightenment.
But then they're going to say, whose morality?
Okay, so there's another thought, you know. Intelligence and morality, those are two important things about what make us human, but I don't think they're sufficient. I do think that the body is important, too, by the way. We were going to say, you know, is intelligence the only thing that matters? And I think the answer to that is to say, Jesus Christ had a body, therefore the body is important. And I think that incarnational mode of theology and thinking is something that's super important, and it's really important to me personally anyway. But anyway,
I'm sorry, go ahead.
What I wanted to say was that I don't think that it's merely our intelligence or our morality which make us different from beasts, but where they meet, where they fuse, where they fuse is the imagination. Because the imagination is the bridge between the heart and the mind, as Michael Carter is fond of putting it.
Cross-reference.
Yeah. And so I think that you are, and I mentioned art earlier, you are never going to find a monkey drawing a picture of another monkey. Ever. You know.
Right.
Because an important thing that G.K. Chesterton says is that the earliest thing we know about human beings is that they were drawing pictures in caves of things. They were looking at nature, and they were drawing pictures of it. They were thinking about it. They, you know, you could, if you look at it, you can kind of tell the psychology of the artist by looking at it. By the way, Chesterton was an artist. He went through art school. That was his profession. And he was saying, okay, well, the way this guy is drawing this, you know, it's something, he's thought about it. He's thought about the way the creature, an animal moves. He's thought about the effect of colors on the eye. He's thought about these things.
Right.
And in doing so, he's kind of stepped away from nature, from the world in which he is a part, and represented it, which implies that he himself, there is a part of him which is outside of nature, which can look at nature from a vantage point of something supernatural in the literal meaning of the word.
Yeah.
He can step away from nature, and
That's right. It's the same. It's kind of the same as what I was describing earlier with the scene from the movie. Is that it's a wholly different concept. You know, it's just. It's completely foreign to us. I mean, it's like if aliens came down and said, you know, I don't know. Oh, you know, you could have traveled through space all along. You know, all you got to do is this: tap your heels together three times. You know, and it's kind of that same concept of something that's supernatural. It's outside of what the normal paradigm
is. And I think you're absolutely right in that joy does the same thing, because joy is not, you don't have joy. You know, joy is a verb. Joy is, and the translation of it would be to desire something, which you cannot have in this life, you are never going to have in this life, but you want it. It's a longing. It's the Germans actually have a word for it.
Schadenfreude.
that's the patriarch's favorite German word, and he's gonna say it every time.
I just think it's a wonderful thing.
Schadenfreude.
Schadenfreude.
Yeah. I get a lot of it too, though. You know.
I mean, Hillary Clinton's email server is a constant source of Schadenfreude from it. I mean, they ought to gold plate it and, you know, put it on. It might end up doing more for American society than anything in the past 20 years.
So when the patriarch earlier was talking about joy, this is what he meant. Yeah. Anyway. Yeah. Well, the German word I was looking for.
Yeah.
Oh, by the way, the German word for ambulance is Krankenwagen, which I think is hilarious.
What is it for milk duds?
Milk duds? I have no idea. I'm not learning German. I'm learning Spanish.
Mm. Okay. Go.
Spanish and sign language.
Leche duds.
Leche duds. Yeah.
I'm sorry. Go ahead. But the German word that you were getting ready to tell us about is?
Sehnsucht. I think that's how you pronounce it. I don't
Bless
know.
You.
Yeah, well, the patriarch can, or the professor can actually tell you all sorts of things about this, because he connected this to the concept of joy, which, and Sehnsucht is to be homesick for a home you've never been to, basically.
Okay.
To be homesick to a home you've never been to want something you've never tasted, to desire something that you have never, that you don't even know exists. That's, it's like, Lewis puts it this way, he says, it's as if, a fish had a concept of dry land. Now, a fish has never seen dry land, a fish has never been on dry land, a fish lives in water. It would be very odd for a fish to have a concept of oxygen, because, the only possible reason that a fish is born having a concept of a world outside of the water is if, possibly, one day he is destined to become a land animal.
Right.
And we have this desire for something supernatural, beyond nature. Why is that? That's a, you know, and that's, it's not a, it's no trump card for Christianity. Just because we have a desire for something means it must be there. Of course, you know, you can't prove that. But it's, I think it's a really important argument. It's a really important thing to think about, is that these desires we have for something which cannot be satisfied outside, you know, within our world, ought to tell us a little bit about, you know, just logically thinking about it. About that, you know, and that's imagination. To have joy, you have to kind of imagine that there are things that joy, you know. And for me, joy is almost always really connected with sorrow, with loss, with not having things. I don't know, and it's kind of difficult to verbalize this, I think, because it's a really nebulous thing. Of course, the theological answer here is to say, well, it is, you desire God. You know, every desire you've ever had is for God. You know, everything you're looking for, that is what you are
right.
looking for. Even if you still haven't found what you're looking for, as some of us have not, apparently. And
yeah, I'd buy that, because even
yeah
even in you know before. Before, I keep going back to my engineering, I guess, but before something can be built, and I was talking earlier about the communication part of that, someone has to imagine it.
Yeah.
They have to see it in their, they have to see it in their mind, they have to understand what the, you know, how all these functions are to come together. Well, you know, in other words, they do what they call programming, and you know that needs to the building needs to function in this way. Well, there's literally an infinite number of combinations to make that happen, you know. And yet the architect has to, you know, he has to in his mind work out all of those scenarios into something that's functional, that can be built and all that. And the same is true for, you know, the guy that put together your computer. I mean, we kind of go by it every day. With all this turmoil in the world, a lot of times you'll see these riots going on or some just bizarre happening going on, and folks talking about wanting to, you know, bring down Western civilization, and they're doing it with a cell phone in their hand that they have no clue as to how it was built or the imagination or the effort it took to put that together. It's a tangent. You don't get me started, right? But that's a beautiful thing, is for somebody to see something, and I hate to say it, just in the physical side of things, you know, the manufacturing side. I gravitate to that, and I really shouldn't. But
towards the arty side, right?
It also works for the Mona Lisa, and for great works of art, great works of music, right?
Mm-hmm.
Those things are endearing, and they're wonderful things, but they have to be imagined. They have to be created.
That's something, you know, and this is sort of a tangent, but I think that we've come to approach art in, I don't know, almost pragmatic terms, to say, you know, if it's just a piece of art, it's not really, you know, some people are like, well, you know, it's not at all important that ISIS is destroying all these cultural landmarks and things. And, you know, of course, immediately they say, well, it's more important that they're killing people. And I'm like, absolutely, of course, you know. But at the same time, I'm thinking, you know, this culture is being wiped out. And our society in general seems to have an inclination to wipe out history if we think we can kind of reshape history. Things like the whole Confederate flag thing. I've written before that I think that the flag should have come down. But this idea that if we just remove landmarks and if we remove things that happened, that we can kind of atone for that history or somehow wipe it out. You know, particularly going on the attack of people like Robert E. Lee, you know, that's kind of ridiculous, because if you've got to engage history. And Robert E. Lee is a really complicated figure. He wasn't a racist, at least not by the standards of his day. He was far ahead of his time. He was no Northern abolitionist, but at the same time, he was a man you have to take in his own context. And as I recall, he freed his slaves. He hated slavery. He had written extensively on how he wished it would end, but he fought for the South. And, you know, I really have no idea where I'm going with this, but just the idea that art, that landmarks and those methods of communication from days past, if they're the wrong sort of art or, you know, from people we don't like or something, we feel like we can just kind of destroy them and wipe that out. I don't know. It just kind of feels like it's a suppression of past thought.
Well, I agree with that, and I also agree that that art has been dumbed down, right? Now, who was it here recently that kind of went on that rambling? Was it a podcast I listened to talking about? I think it was maybe one of Milt Rosenberg. The man. The man.
Patriarch's a huge fan.
Might have been talking about that. But that, you know, that I can take a crucifix and suspend it in a jar of urine and call that art and get paid for it by the government is ridiculous. You know, I mean, it's anything but artistic. I mean, art, I think, should convey skill in order to create that, and imagination. That's imagination that a 5-year-old would get. Oh, I know what it was, and because one of the guys that was talking about it, I think it was Milt's show. He was an art teacher, like a professor, okay. And he, one of the things that he said he would do, is he would take this piece of art, you know, abstract art, and he would show it to his students, and he would say, "Describe it." And they would use words like evocative and bold, and they obviously were searching for the most flamboyant words that they could, like I just did right there. And he said, "Well, what you just saw is just a small piece of my apron that I use in the shop." You know, in other words, he just clipped out a part of it, like photocopied it, and said, "Here it is." You know, it was a rag, you know.
Yeah.
And it was passed off as art. And
it reminds me of a recent video I watched from, I think, Prager University that was talking about kind of the way that we have lost standards for art.
Yeah, that's right. And so imagination, that's almost not a heresy of imagination or of art, but it's certainly a dumbing down. There's probably a better word for it than that.
Well, it's
blasphemous form of art.
If imagination is the bridge between the heart and the mind, that's to take any emotional, any feeling you've got, you know, any feeling you've got, and just throw it out there without any wisdom, mental discipline.
It's all on the mind's part and no heart, right?
I was going the other way with that. Oh. But I was thinking, like, there's no intellectual restraint there. It's just like anything you kind of have come into your mind or your heart or whatever.
Yeah,
you just throw it out there without thinking it through, and I think that, you know, perhaps both sides of that equation are failing each other, and that you just throw out something intellectual without applying your heart, or the other way around. You know, it's I don't know. It's there's no.
Well, and again, I mentioned it earlier in a little bit. Is there's no discipline involved. Restraint. There's no restraint, you know. But there's no discipline involved in applying to that imagination, because I can imagine a lot of really bad things, right?
Yeah.
Now you said there was morality, and you said there was morality and imagination, right?
Intellect,
and I threw in discipline too. And I think those do kind of make a three legs of the stool. Because if you have two out of the three, it seems like you can get off track pretty badly.
Yeah, it seems like. Yeah, I mean, I believe that art is imitation. Art imitates reality as it is. And that can mean to tell a story or to paint a picture. And it can be of good things or bad things or cruel things, you know, terrible things. As long as you be truthful, you know, about it, it's a representation of the world as God has made it, or as sin has corrupted it. You know, just as long as you're approaching that truthfully, you know, and that's what the Bible does, for instance. It doesn't sugarcoat things. It doesn't go into really negative, pessimistic images of reality like a lot of modern novels either. But it's realism. But I think that if you look at a lot of modern art, and this is another good, interesting thing Indy Wilson says about it, is it shows what artists see, what modern secular artists see when they look at reality, and they see chaos and randomness and ugliness and, a Jackson Pollock painting. And Indy Wilson, as he points out, he says, if you actually look at reality, does it look more like a Jackson Pollock painting? Confusion and random atoms, or does it look more like Rembrandt?
Yeah.
You know, and the reality is that the world looks like it's ordered and planned and written.
Right.
You know,
that's a good point. Yeah.
So it's, I think that a lot of it comes down to just the way they see the world. You can look at the way they portray the world, they use their imagination, but they don't bring the truth to bear on that. It's just a kind of a, it's an imagination based on a falsehood.
Which I can kind of understand, and I'm a guy that kind of likes modern art a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
But I must say that after listening to that, and what Indy Wilson said, which I'd heard before, and then this recent podcast, and was like, you know, well, wait a minute, because I can understand. I guess where I was going with that is I can understand an artist maybe doing that in order to express his, you know, randomness and that his particular issues, but to sell it to the art community at large says something about. I think that says something about
the community's
vision and ability to really discern and use that wisdom again to discern what's really good and what's not. I mean, I think that's true. I was telling Bible study a while back about the piece of music that's like called 4:33, 4 minutes and 33 seconds of silence.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
And basically the guy comes out, sits down at the piano for, and it may be like 33 minutes. I forget the name of it. But, and he sits there and he doesn't play a note, and there's complete silence for 4 minutes and 33 seconds or whatever, or 33 minutes, I forget. And then he gets up and walks off, and that's the entire performance. That's, and people pay for it, and people buy it based on, you know, so, and it's almost like the king doesn't have any clothes because they don't want to be the one that doesn't look like they have the intellect to appreciate the
depth. Yeah, I would kind of love to be a kid, you know, in the front audience and just die laughing, like, this is ridiculous.
Yeah.
You know.
Hey, I brought my violin. Does anybody mind if I play something?
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. Well, we need to go ahead and wrap up, because I didn't actually expect any of these questions to generate as much discussion as they have, but it's turned out to be pretty interesting. Anyway, I want to end by quoting a segment of Tolkien. And I think that...
What did he write?
He wrote a little short story called Leaf by Niggle, which he's famous for. And Tolkien, and I think that these are kind of the ideas we've been talking about so far, is the idea of man as a creator. Man as a creator in the shape of the ultimate creator. And Tolkien, that was central to his theology, central to the way he saw the world. And if you really read his works with... knowing some of his thoughts on that in mind, some of his philosophy on that, it's really fascinating. I've been rereading The Two Towers and noticing just all sorts of details of incarnational thought and stuff. Anyway, he wrote a poem called Mythopoeia, and in which he, part of the poem, he describes man's creativity. And I'm going to quote that segment. He refers to man as a sub-creator. Though now long estranged, man is not wholly lost nor wholly changed. Disgraced he may be, yet is not dethroned, and keeps the rags of lordship once he owned. His world dominion by creative act, not his to worship the great artifact. Man, sub-creator, the refracted light, through whom is splintered from a single white to many hues and endlessly combined in living shapes that move from mind to mind. Though all the crannies of the world we filled with elves and goblins, though we dared to build gods and their houses out of dark and light, and sowed the seed of dragons, 'twas our right, used or misused. The right has not decayed. We make still by the law in which we're made. And on that note, I guess we better go ahead and wrap it up.
This has been very creative.
Yeah.
Very imaginative.
I guess now the question is, what are we going to do next week?
I don't know if I have an answer for that.
I still have some questions left from this week. Actually, we only got about halfway through, so maybe we'll just talk about those. I was going to talk about Gnosticism and the body and how we commodify the body, how we treat it like a machine, different things, and stuff. So maybe we'll talk about that. You know, I want to watch A Man for All Seasons soon again, and I think we need to do a podcast on that, though. So.
Okay.
Just the enthusiasm. It's infectious. Anyway, I guess next week we'll talk about Gnosticism. So all you heretics, tune in. And
if you ever have a little boy, you're gonna name him Thomas More, whatever.
Yeah, I guess so. Anyway, in the meantime,
I grew up with a Tommy Moore.
Yeah,
I did. Different one.
In the meantime, you can find us online at the Pilgrims Podcast blog. We're on Facebook. We're on Twitter. I'm on Tumblr on several locations. I run a blog called Longish. The Patriarch's got one called What's He That Wishes So.
I'm gonna try and do more. I'm gonna try and write more. I'm gonna try and do that.
He's gotten a little bit of feedback on his writing, and it's. He's all excited now. You guys need to go read his blog, so and maybe he'll actually write something again if you comment on it and tell him how amazing he is.
For how amazingly bad it is.
Actually, you know, I was just rereading some of your stuff on there, and it was really good stuff. You know, I need to share it again. Anyway, so.
Some depth. Well, thanks for everybody joining us this week.
Yep.
Hope you have a wonderful end of the summer and Labor Day and all that great stuff.
Yep.
Maybe, maybe we'll talk to politics. You know. And the Hokies play Ohio State Monday night.
Okay.
Big game.
Well, I guess we will see you guys next week. Make sure you use your imaginations wisely.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yep. Goodbye.
Money that e'er I had, I spent it in good company, and all the harm I've ever done, alas, it was to none but me. And all I've done for want of wit, to memory now I can't recall. So fill to me parting glass, good night and joy be to you all. Sorry for my going away, and all the sweethearts that
the night.